south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. I'd like to start out by telling you today I'm doing this show on emergency power at Expat Eddie's house. I'm powered up today by a little 5-horsepower gas generator. Maybe you can hear it buzzing in the background in his garage. So don't let it bother you. Anyway, I'm hoping Eddie's gas generator doesn't poop out before the end of the show, and I hope he's got an extra can of gas, because my days of siphoning are over. Actually, I don't think I've done that since high school. So how come I'm on a backup generator today? Well, it's like this. A huge storm rolled in about 4 hours ago, and it knocked down a huge tree right in front of Eddie's house, which is bad enough, but it fell on a power pole and hit the transformer and snapped the wires leading to Eddie's place. Now, people always wonder how much the power really does go out in Latin America, since everybody knows this is the third world. Which, of course, makes you think of blackouts and water shortages and washed-out highways, not to mention hurricanes, earthquakes, tsunamis, floods, and volcanoes. Because up north, that's the kind of news you get coming out of Latin America. I mean, come on, everyone loves a disaster as long as it's not in your hometown, right? Which begs the question, how long is this power outage going to last? How long is a typical power outage? And more importantly, how many power outages like this one can one expect yearly or monthly or weekly? I mean, you know, up north, every once in a while you get a power outage. But I remember back in Chicago, even during a heavy snowstorm, if you did have an outage, it only lasted maybe a half an hour. Barring, of course, huge, unusual events like Hurricane Sandy. Now, I know I mentioned this on a show a long time ago, but when I first came down to Latin America 20 years ago, when I was hanging around Costa Rica, Panama City, Panama, and Cartagena, Colombia a lot, I was actually almost able to set my watch by the power outage. Usually on a Friday about 5 o'clock at night for about 2 or 3 hours, because that's when everyone was getting home from work and going out to party on a Friday night. Then there'd generally be another short power outage of 2 or 3 hours on Saturday or Sunday or both. Always, it seemed, when folks were off for work and partying on the weekend. And I kind of suspect that's when people clicked on their room air conditioners, so the bedroom at least could be nice and cool for the weekend for a comfortable sleep. Because, like I may have mentioned, down here, electricity is very expensive, so even people with real money rarely put central air conditioning in their houses, but instead put a wall or a window unit just in the master bedroom. Except, of course, if you live in the Altiplano like I do, then you don't need it at all. But some people like beach living, and you're going to need air conditioning if you do. Though I'm warning you, if you like air conditioning, get ready for a huge electric bill. So anyway, way back when all the Latin American governments owned and operated the electric power companies in their region, you could count on your power going out twice a week at least, for an hour or two, maybe more. But now that all the Latin American countries have sold off all or part of their electric utilities to some first world power distribution company that actually knows what it's doing, there are no brownouts or rolling blackouts, except in those countries that maintain a strong grip on their electric companies, like Venezuela and Cuba. Yeah, Venezuela again. That always makes me laugh, since they're something like the fifth biggest oil producer in the world and actually have enough geothermal power in their country, that is, if they'd actually develop it and use it, to power 4 more countries their size. Not to mention, they've got enough oil for personal use to last about 200 years. But they'd rather sell it all on the world market for dollars, even though they claim to hate the dollar. But that's another story. But you see, in the rest of Latin America, just about the only time you have a power outage is when there's some kind of storm, natural disaster, or some idiot chicken bus driver slams into a utility pole. And how often does that happen? Well, I'd say pretty much throughout Latin America, you could count on a power outage about 5 or 6 times a week in the rainy season and maybe once or twice a week in the dry season. Say what, Johnny? 1 to 6 times a week a power outage? You kidding me? Well, don't freak out about that till you hear this. Now, those multiple weekly power outages last about 1 second or less. Almost always nearly imperceptible or just a flicker. In fact, so fast that most times you wouldn't even know it, except for the fact that most of us gringos and expats have lights hooked up to motion sensors around our houses. And I do suggest you have a few of those around the house, because they're cheap and effective deterrents. Anyway, as good as those things are at picking up moving objects, they're still a bit of a pain to have in Latin America because those things just weren't designed to be in places where momentary power outages like that exist. And here's why. If you want to override the motion sensor function, in other words, just have it work as a regular old light on a light switch, then you have to override the sensor mode, and it's easy. To do that, the instructions say you flick your light switch on and off really fast one time. Then the light will remain on, and it won't be in the sensor mode, which is a nice feature if you want to leave your light on all night, as opposed to the normal sensor mode that has your light on a timer. You know how it works. Once some kind of motion is detected, then your light flicks on from 1 to 15 minutes, and there's a little dial on the unit where you can vary that. You know what I mean. But you can override all of that by just flicking the switch on and off really fast, provided, of course, you've got it hooked up to a regular light switch, which most are. Now, can you see the problem? When there's a momentary power outage of about a second or less, which happens more than a few times a week, no matter where you are down here in Latin America, when that happens, the circuitry in that light thinks you're overriding the sensor, so your light will stay on forever until it burns out or you turn it off. And I know there's a simple electronic fix to that. In fact, I know how to do it, but I hung up my engineering chops a long time ago. Just suffice it to say, no one's put the Latin American model on the market yet. You see, the thing is, all those cheap motion sensor light units everyone everywhere has been using for the last 30 or so years, well, they were originally designed for consumers up in the States, where the power is generally rock steady. Yep, they were designed in the States, made in China by slave labor, and shipped worldwide, including down here in Latin America, where they don't quite work so well. And that's why all of us who have those things will wake up in the morning occasionally and find our outside lights permanently on for who knows how long. That means sometime during the night, we had some very fleeting, nearly imperceptible power outage, which completely fooled our stupid motion sensors. So yes, we have multiple power outages here, but unless you have motion sensors, you'll almost never notice. And of course, during the rainy season, you'll occasionally have a power outage of an hour or two, maybe once or twice a month. And that's not because of poor infrastructure or some kind of negligence on the part of the company. It's almost always because of something uncontrollable, like a lightning strike, or a tree that's clipped some power lines, or a drunk chicken bus driver who's kissed a power pole. And when that happens, some folks call it Darwinism. And you should know this. If you live out in the boonies or in the coffee fields like I do, occasionally it'll just be your house or your property that gets the power outage. Meaning the fallen tree, the lightning strike, or the drunken chicken bus driver just happened to hit the nearest utility pole or transformer on your corner. So then what do you do, and how fast do they respond? Well, I'll tell you, because the electric companies are now privately owned, when you call to complain, they'll respond about 10 times faster than any complaint to the cops. That's if the cops even show up. And in fact, I've had some transformer and line damage a couple of times over the years, and for me, the electric company's response time spent about 2 hours. And that's even though I know damn well, after a heavy storm, there's a lot of damage and a lot of trees down. But still, they're on it. That's what it's like these days, now that electric companies are private and they have to actually satisfy their customers. Now, 5 or so years ago, I remember waiting 2 whole days to get a simple repair like that done. A repair that took 2 guys and a ladder like 5 minutes to fix. Back when corrupt, inefficient, lard-ass, thieving governments owned the utility companies. And thank Buddha, those days are long gone. Now, just one last thing about those tiny, momentary power outages, 98% of which you never notice. Now, when that happens, your electronics and appliances never even skip a beat. You can be using your computer or watching your TV and doing a load of dirty underwear. Never fear. Those electrical appliances of yours will just happily chug along. But know this, and it's more than a suggestion. Do go out and get yourself a UPS for your computer. Even down here, a decent one will only cost about 40 or 50 bucks. Oh, and for the uninitiated, UPS stands for Uninterrupted Power Supply. Not to be confused with United Parcel Service, the guys in the brown trucks that deliver junk to your house. That is, unless you have your UPS delivered by UPS, which is quite possible. And yes, they have both of those kind of UPSs down here in Latin America. All right. Anyhow, do get yourself one of those uninterrupted power supplies, at least for your computer or computers. Whereas all your other appliances like flat-screen TVs and refrigerators and such are really pretty rugged and can handle those occasional little fleeting power outages that end up causing a lot of damaging little electrical ripples and spikes, in computers, they're much more delicate. Your computer can really only take so much of that on and off stuff. And I know for a fact, since I was an engineer in a past life, so don't send me emails trying to correct me on this one, I know I'm right. Now here's a fact you may never have heard. 90% of all electronic failures, including computers, in fact, that statistic came from testing computers. Anyway, 90% of all electronic failures occur when switching on the device. And that's why so many thousands of businesses these days never turn their computers off at all. That means they're left on all night and weekends too. Because believe it or not, if you never turn your computer off, you can predict that it'll last twice to three times as long before there's a catastrophic failure. That versus a computer that you turn on and off every time you want to use it. And sure, computers and all electronics have protection against certain power line fluctuations and surges like that, but the fact is, there's nothing that conditions a power line and makes it nice and level and smooth, consistent, and dependable than a nice, cheap, uninterrupted power supply, a UPS. It might be the best $50 you ever spent. And by the way, the thing that comes in second as a computer killer or electronic killer in general is heat, which is something else most people don't think about. And that means when you run a computer in Latin America, unless you're in the Altiplano or in an air-conditioned space, your computer by nature is going to be running awful hot. And that, I guarantee, will shorten its life. That's why I suggest at least once weekly you blow out the fan hole. God, that didn't sound right. Well, you know what I mean. That is, go to the back of your tower or the backside of your laptop, notebook, or whatever, and blow a little air into the fan port, then get ready to sneeze because there's going to be a cloud of dust, not to mention a few insect carcasses, dead if you're lucky. So try not to inhale those. And that dust coating throughout the inside of your machine is what causes so many computers to overheat and then prematurely fail. And if you don't believe me about that overheating bit, you have to ask yourself why all the big companies that have server and network hardware keep those things tucked away in very low temperature rooms. Not to mention, the colder an integrated circuit is, the faster the operating speed. But you knew that, right? That's why scientists are so obsessed with absolute zero. You knew that too, I know. Anyway, I'm giving you this information just so you know that the general climate down here in Latin America is pretty harsh on things, especially electronic equipment like computers. The exception being when you're in the Altiplano. Then, pretty much the only thing you have to worry about is that six-month rainy season. That's when there could be a lot of excess humidity in your house or office because Latins have this odd tendency to build houses and buildings that are dark and dank and promote humidity and mildew. In other words, architects and builders down here are not big on natural lighting, which is stupid. But I won't go into that by changing the subject again, I promise. Now, I'm not saying if you bring a computer down or you buy one here, it's going to automatically fail in a year or two or have half the life it would up in the States. Though it might only last that long if all you do is pound away at it all day sitting on a deck chair on the beach. Nice life for you, but crappy for your computer. The salt, the heat, and the beer might be your idea of a good time, but for one thing, computers don't like beer. And I'm not suggesting you buy the extended warranty either, since those nearly always end up being a losing proposition. Though there are exceptions to everything. For example, if I needed a pacemaker now. Anyway, just to give you an example, I bought a computer down here about 5 years ago, one of the cheaper models, a compact laptop that ran around $400. And believe me, in that 5 years, I put some mega hours on this thing, and it's never crashed and burned. Not yet. Oh, it's had its share of viruses and hiccups and stuff, but not a single hardware repair at all. In fact, believe it or not, I've done every single one of my 299 radio shows with my audio software on this very computer. And I've written a couple of books and tons of articles with this machine, too. It's certainly nothing special, but it's a workhorse, and who knows how long it's going to last. But one thing I do know, if I was living at the beach, it would have died a long time ago. And by the way, just so you know, I practice what I preach. When I'm not traveling, sometimes I leave this old thing on for days, weeks, and even a month or two at a time. Nope, I rarely turn it off. And yes, at least once a week, I blow out the fan hole. God, that sounds terrible, huh? Okay, enough said about that. Last show, I promised I'd finish a story that I never got around to finishing, so I will. But first, let me take just a couple seconds to mention that my upcoming January 2014 Expat Wisdom Latin American Seminar is all now arranged, booked, and scheduled. And a long blurb with the details should be up on the expatwisdom.com main page by Monday or Tuesday. So, if you want to know what it's all about, where we're going, who we're going to meet, and the pricing and the discounts, just go to expatwisdom.com on the main page, and there should be a big reference to it, or a link on the top that says Seminar. And by the way, like I mentioned a while back, there'll be some flexible payment options this time, so check it out and see what you're missing if you don't sign on. Now, if you remember last time, I was talking about the cost of living and how to relate living like a first world person down here in Latin America to people living up in the States in various sections of the country. Since depending on what you read or who you talk to, the comparisons can be all over the place. So what should you believe? Or should you just take it all with a grain of salt? And remember, I closed off the last show by mentioning an old retired friend of mine living down here, off the tourist trail, of course, who lives solely off his $1,500 a month Social Security check, which is direct deposited to a dollar account in a Latin bank down here. And on that subject, you should know that practically every single Latin American bank now offers U.S. dollar savings, checking, and passbook accounts, also tied to debit and credit cards, if you like. And the nice thing is, unlike years ago when I first got down here and U.S. dollar accounts were rather rare, unlike back then, there are absolutely no extra charges or fees attached if you do have a U.S. dollar account. That is, there are no more extra charges and fees compared to having a local currency account. For example, pesos, reals, bolivars, lempiras, or colones. Whatever Latin funny money you choose. Like, the U.S. dollar isn't funny money. Ha ha. The only thing is, if you have a U.S. dollar account, you'll have to keep a minimum balance in there, or they will start hitting you with charges. But with most Latin banks, it's almost always between $100 or $500 bucks. Not bad. Now, that's for a personal account in your name. And as you probably know by now, I never recommend opening up a foreign bank account in your own name. Unless, of course, you're setting up a direct deposit account for your Social Security or U.S. government disability check. Because as far as I can tell, the account has to be in the check holder's name. Oh, and by the way, I've been warning you guys, and finally it's come true. It's now impossible for any gringo to come down to Latin America and open up a bank account, whether in the local currency or in dollars, without the aid of a local lawyer. In fact, it used to be you could walk into any bank, especially in the commercial and tourist zones, just whip out your passport, deposit $100, and get an instant passbook savings account. Well, not instant by our standards. Maybe it would take an hour or an hour and a half. But for Latin America, that's considered instant, practically superhuman. Now, of course, if you were to open a business account, and down here, as you know, they're called SA corporations. S standing for Sociedad, and A standing for Anonima. English translation, an anonymous society account. Anyway, to open a business account like that in a bank down here, you'd have to have a lawyer for sure, because he's the guy that would set up your SA corporation, which would be used to open that account. Now, just to clarify things about business accounts, because people have been asking me about this. If, for example, you already have a business up in the States and a business account at a bank there, you cannot just come down here to a bank in Latin America and open a bank account here. Even if you hauled down all your company's legal paperwork and had it translated in Spanish and then handed it over to the bank representative here. That won't work down here. It's not allowed. You can only get a business bank account in a Latin American bank if that business is incorporated in the country where the bank is. You get it, right? That means if you have a business that was incorporated in Chicago, that business can open bank accounts anywhere in the States, but not down here in Latin America. You have to create a brand new corporation down here to do that. And of course, many times the same business name is available down here. So, for example, you could have the XYZ Corporation up in the States, and down here, the XYZ SA Corporation. And that's what a lot of people who are in the import-export business do. And by the way, if you come down to my seminar, I'll be introducing you to my favorite Latin lawyer. And while here, you'll learn about all that stuff in great detail right from the horse's mouth. Oh, and by the way, if you get one of those SA corporations down here and open a business bank account, your initial deposit to open that account will be in the range of $500 to $1,000. And you'll have to maintain that or get hit with extra monthly charges. That's why I hate banks. What else is new? Oh, and one more thing. Banks down here do nickel and dime you to death on your statement, but not near as much as banks up in the first world. And those crazy extra charges you see on your statements are just as hard to decipher as your statements from the First National Bank of Cleveland. That means, for example, if you have a bank account down here, let's say you have a peso and a dollar account, and it's connected to a debit card and a MasterCard and a checking account, you can bet, just like up in the first world, funky little charges are going to show up on your bank statement that you're never going to go down and fight the bank over, because the time wasted driving over there, phoning up, or sitting down at the customer service desk is not going to be worth the $3.46 miscellaneous charge that suddenly appeared on your statement. And by the way, I don't know what it's like up in the first world, but down here in Latin America, it's absolutely futile, even if your Spanish is perfect, to try to resolve any kind of banking problem over the phone. For that matter, down here, it's futile to try to solve any kind of billing problem over the phone. Whether it's your water company, your electric bill, or your phone company, whatever. And this you should know. If you open a bank account in the local currency or dollars, if, for example, you're out of the country for 5 years or so, and there's been no activity on that account, they can lock you out permanently. So for all you international travelers out there, that's why it's a good idea to have your foreign account or accounts linked to a debit card. That way, if you're gone from the country for a long, long time, at least you can go to an ATM machine anywhere in the world and withdraw 10 or 20 bucks, and that's, of course, considered account activity, and you only have to do that every 5 years or so. Now, what I've heard from bankers down here is that these institutions make a lot of money on gringos and foreigners with inactive accounts that after some years they can legally confiscate. As foreigners do trickle in, a good percentage of them do open up passbook savings accounts, at least when it was easy to do so. And in a country like Costa Rica, where hundreds of thousands of gringo tourists land every year, those small-time nickel-and-dime passbook accounts really add up. In fact, I've known a lot of gringos and expats who go to tourist areas like Costa Rica and think it quite the cool thing to open a passbook savings account, even one with just 50 bucks in it, thinking, hey man, this is cool, I'm international now, I've got a foreign bank account. Of course, now all that's ended in the last year or so with Big Brother and all that FATCA crap, but back then, even backpackers opened tiny little passbook savings accounts, if not just to have a place to transfer mommy and daddy's money down when they ran short. So guess what happens to all these first world tourists and their tens of thousands of nickel and dime foreign bank passbook accounts? Well, as they go back to the States and Europe and get on with their lives and forget about Costa Rica, Jamaica, Cancun, or wherever they had that beach bum backpacker vacation of a lifetime, well, as time rolls on, after a while, that little passbook with 200 bucks in it gets stuck in a drawer or in a closet or in a safety deposit box and is out of sight and out of mind. And who would think that an account like that can be seized if there's no activity after 5 or so years? Who reads the fine print when you open a bank account, even when it's in English? But when it's in Spanish? Come on. And after some years, even if you discovered that little passbook again, who'd go back down just to recover 200 bucks? And in fact, way back when, I had quite a few college and high school buddies that did the backpacking through Latin America and Europe thing, and a lot of them opened passbook bank accounts for 50 or 100 bucks for those very same reasons. The coolness factor and the slim possibility that it could actually be useful. I mean, when you're a college kid on spring break or summer vacation, becoming a real-life expat is the farthest thing from your mind. Hell, when I was 20 years old, I didn't even know what an expat was. Anyway, you can just imagine how many gringo college kids and backpackers opened little nickel and dime accounts like that and simply abandoned them, especially before the age of smartphones and checking your account online. And you know what? Those jerks that work at the banks, they know that. They count on it. The stupid foreigner syndrome again, huh? And you know, I was one of those stupid gringos too. I lost a few small-time European bank accounts that way. Oh well, you live and learn. Maybe. So the real question for us is, with the new FATCA laws, where all foreign banks must report to the IRS the names of all U.S. citizens who have bank accounts, Well, what about all those hundreds of thousands of abandoned nickel and dime accounts that were opened so many years ago and just abandoned? The question is, who is on that list and how far does it go back? Someday, are you going to get a threatening letter or phone call from the IRS or stopped at a border and quizzed about some Mexican bank account you opened in a peyote haze back in the 70s? You know, these days, nothing would surprise me. To me, it's just another straw on the camel's back and another reason to get the hell out of Dodge. Anyway, like I said, on the last show, I was talking about one of my retired friends who was living solely on a Social Security check of about $1,500 a month, supporting a family of five. And of course, he's living way off the Gringo tourist trail, so he appears not to have much trouble doing that on his little Social Security check. Now, when I ask him how he compares his lifestyle to his brother and his sister who still live up in New York, he tells me, Johnny, you know what? I just can't compare my lifestyle on my Social Security check with my sister and brother up north who barely live a first world life on a private pension and a Social Security check. And by the way, this guy lives in the immediate suburbs of a big Latin city. And like I said before, he has a nice little weekend beach house. Very rustic and simple, but still, he has a beach house. And it's bought and paid for. Do you? Now, I know I might have mentioned this before, but I know a 50-ish Latin guy living down here in the Altiplano who happens to be in the government secret service, their version of the FBI. I know, big deal. Whoopee, right? But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about cost of living now. And this friend of mine, who's a government agent working as a presidential guard, and he's occasionally assigned as a personal bodyguard for pompous, lard-ass visiting dignitaries too. Like U.S. congressmen down here spending your money and good-for-nothing shit-for-brains like Hillary Clinton and Kerry and other pompous U.S. government asswipes, as well as U.N. officials and such, also traveling and living the high life on your dime. Anyway, this Latin guy I know down here handholds first world and third world diplomatic jerks that need to be protected and chauffeured around. Protected from what? I don't know. Now, if you ask me, these jerks should have zero protection and be forced to ride the chicken bus, but no one asked me. Oh, and by the way, they should all be enrolled in Obamacare too, but that's another story. Now, basically, this guy's been a presidential guard for the last 20 years, and he makes a grand total of $1,000 US a month, a little over three times the minimum wage here. Uh-oh, looks like I'm hitting the wall on time again. So next time, I'll pick this right up where I left off. You're gonna like how this one turns out.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to the Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture.